I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week are First World War letters. Over 100 years ago, the First World War was marked by battles in the trenches, stalemate for 4 years, but also being a total war. And the idea that everybody, both those on the front lines and those back at home, had a role to play. And a lot of the information that we have about that comes from letters. And that is the subject of a new book by Martha Hanna entitled Anxious Days and Tearful Nights, Canadian War Wives During the Great War, in which Martha explores some of these letters back and forth between soldiers on the front line and their wives back in Canada, and really gets into some of the struggles associated with trying to maintain a marriage at great distance and only through letters. There was obviously the uncertainty of, would the soldier in question survive, get through the war? They were in a lot of danger, of course, but also questions about, what do you tell them? Or if the kids are sick, do you want to mention that? Or would that just cause them some unnecessary anxiety, especially given that by the time the letter gets there, the kid's probably going to be okay if it's a minor illness. So those sorts of questions that women on the home front are dealing with, it really gets into the challenges that women are facing at home. A wonderful profile and an incredible use of these primary sources. And given my professional connection now to the First World War, I had a great interest in this book and was very pleased that Martha agreed to speak with me. Very much enjoyed the conversation. Think you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Martha Hanna. And Martha Hanna joins me now. How are you today, Martha?
I'm well. How are you? Thank you for inviting me.
I'm thrilled that you are here. We were just talking offline about the book. As I said in the intro, a lot of personal interest for me in Anxious Days and Tearful Nights. I'm always curious where people get their ideas from, the genesis of projects. You were just telling me a little bit about where this idea came from, because as the subtitle in the book says, it's about Canadians and Canadian brides and women, but you are a French war historian. So how did you get into this project? What was the idea and what made you want to look at the Canadian experience? Okay.
You're absolutely right. I started as a scholar with an interest in the French experience of the First World War. And what I discovered, to my great surprise, was that French soldiers, in their letter writing, especially their letters to their wives and to their mothers, were extraordinarily descriptive and sent harrowing letters about their experiences at the front, watching men die in their arms and so forth. And as I was reading these letters, which were written in the main by highly educated young French soldiers, the intellectual elite of France, I was struck by something that really had been in the back of my mind since I was an undergraduate, which was that soldiers were not supposed to describe and share their experiences of war with the home front. They were supposed to have a stiff upper lip. They were supposed to be constrained by censorship, by self-censorship. And they felt that they couldn't possibly explain to people at home what it was like to be in the war. And so their letters were deemed to be useless as historical documents, because they said nothing of interest. So I was reading these letters written by French soldiers who really had not got that memo. They were not being stiff upper lip, can't tell you anything about the war. They were sharing in harrowing detail their experiences of the war. Not in every letter, but in enough letters that their wives and mothers at home could have a pretty strong sense of what was happening.
Right. So, yeah, like it's interesting because, yeah, that counters the narrative of the people at the home front don't really know what's going on because they're not telling them. But here you're finding letters where people are telling them, because, as you say, the narrative is they say everything's fine. It's a little cold. I want socks, maybe some cigarettes, and maybe some other stuff from home. Like, that's what I want. But that's not what you're finding in these French letters.
Precisely. And so when I first presented that evidence to other scholars, they said, yes, but the people that are writing these letters are highly educated, and they have the background and the literary skill to give voice to their experiences. They're probably the exception. If you start looking at ordinary French soldiers, they're going to be saying the same kind of nonsense that we have always believed were the status quo for soldiers in the First World War. So I went to Paris, and I had the great good fortune to discover this extraordinary collection of letters written by a French peasant, Paul Pirot, who I think finished grade six. And his wife, they were recently married just before the war started, would have had maybe the same, maybe even a little less education. Her spelling was pretty awful. So if you can imagine what, you know, grade six students would be writing in their letters to their parents, that's what it was like. But the letters were so descriptive and so emotional and so affectionate and in some cases actually erotic. I thought, whoa, they aren't supposed to be doing this either. How is it that these soldiers have the means and the inclination to describe the war in such detail, so that, as you so rightly pointed out, the home front did know about the war in ways that we as historians had never fully appreciated? So how do we get to Canada from a French peasant village in the southwest of France? Then I thought, well, maybe the French experience is special. Maybe there's something in their experience as students or in the proximity to the front that allowed them to correspond very frequently, that allowed French families to share this kind of correspondence that really didn't obtain for other soldiers in other countries. Right.
Well, I wonder too, as part of that, as you said, just not only the proximity and the ease with which they could send mail back and forth, but also the fact that so many of them can go home on leave, that they're also seeing them when they're on leave. So, you know, one thing that I would suggest as a possibility, as someone who hasn't studied this in the same depth nearly that you have, is that maybe authorities are saying, well, we don't need to censor the letters because when they go home, they're telling them this anyway, right? We can't censor the conversation. So that would be another potential possibility that I would have suggested this could have been a possibility.
Absolutely, except that the French were so persuaded that they were going to win the war in 6 months. Right, they didn't send anybody home on leave until July of 1915. So the information about the war was making its way home even before, as you very astutely point out, people would be able to talk about this in the intimacy of their own homes. And they certainly did. There's lots of evidence that when soldiers went home, they talked to their families, they talked to their friends' families. They said, you know, I saw Jean-Pierre 2 days ago and he was fine, and all that kind of stuff. So there was oral exchange as well as literary exchange, which couldn't happen for poor Canadian soldiers.
Of course. Yeah.
And the other thing that really struck me was Canadians were so far away from home that perhaps that stifled the inclination or the capacity to write openly about the war in the ways that French soldiers clearly could do and had done. So I thought, I need to use the Canadian case as a counterpoint. Is it the case that if you are physically distant from the war or from your home, that if you don't have the luxury of being able to exchange letters in 2 or 3 days, if you don't have the luxury of going home on leave, which Canadian soldiers didn't unless their home was in the UK, then perhaps they didn't have that same open epistolary tradition and exchange. But the second thing that sort of got me hooked on the idea of using Canada as a counterpoint to the French experience was it helped me answer a question that had been sort of niggling in the back of my mind for decades, which was, what was my great-grandmother's experience of the war like? Because without sending any spoiler alerts, my great-grandmother is one of the women in this book.
Yes. Yeah, because you're, so just for the context of that, it's your great-grandfather who was in the war and died on the war and is on Vimy?
Correct.
Yes. So, yeah, so there's a personal connection. I'll be honest, I'm a, I don't want to say a sucker for these types of, for things, but when there is that personal story and you can weave in it through a well-researched, really good historical book, but also has this personal story that kind of weaves through it, I'm a sucker for that. I love that as a narrative device. I'm all in on it.
And I wish that we, as a family, had preserved the letters that my great-grandmother, my great-grandfather sent home, because we're pretty sure he did. Right. And all we have, this will tell you who my great-grandmother was, is the postcard that he sent just as he was about to embark in Montreal to sail to France. And after that, there was nothing.
Right.
Until the telegram arrived.
Do you have a sense, I mean, do you have a sense of why that would be? And obviously the family lore, the discussions of that, but this is something that, because I'm curious about sources. I do want to talk about sources and finding these letters, but it strikes me that anecdotally, I've heard this same thing from so many people. You always hear about soldiers come home, the ones who live through the war, they don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. What doesn't get talked about nearly as much, I think, are women or families who had somebody die who also don't want to talk about it. And I do wonder if getting rid of letters, even if it doesn't seem rational, actually is part of coping with that, is that they don't want that memory of this person who is then torn away from them, who they didn't see, who presumably died in a very violent way in an unknown place. Like, is that a common experience in your research? And how does that influence letters and finding sources in doing this type of work?
I wish that were the explanation for why none of my great-grandfather's letters survived. Unfortunately, as best I can tell, my great-grandmother did keep whatever letters she had received. And when my grandparents moved into the house, or moved her out of the house, or anyway, did some kind of house cleaning, it was like, who needs this stuff?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, I think, you know, you're really touching on sort of the psychology of bereavement and grief, which is a big theme in the book. But the fact that as many collections of soldiers' letters have survived as has survived, you know, not every collection has survived, but, you know, the Laurie Rogers papers, which are now held in Ottawa, which are just extraordinary. Obviously, Mary Rogers cherished those documents,
right,
and cherished the, you know, the little mementos that were sent home after her husband was killed. So they meant a great deal to her. Going back to, you know, the Paul and Marie Pierrot letters, happily he survived the war, but the fact that Marie kept every letter that he sent home for the duration of the war and stored them in an attic in her home until, you know, they were discovered years later by people who bought the house, meant that they were very cherished. They were that, you know, theme that I touch on in the book, is they were like a thread that kept the marriage together.
Right.
And so I think that people responded to grief in many different ways. And so it is entirely possible that some would have wanted to turn their back on those memories, which would have been so hard. And I don't know, maybe the war widows who then remarried would have felt that. I don't know. It's hard to know.
Right.
You're absolutely right that tracking down these sources is a very arduous enterprise.
Yeah. So let's get into that. And how did you go about it? Because there's so many collections, personal collections. Some get donated to archives, some don't, some end up with families. And for a book like this, as you said at the top, where one of the explanations or potential explanation that you were given was, well, maybe it's because some of the letters you were reading were from well-educated people. In this context, you have people from all across the country, from various backgrounds, various linguistic groups, ethnic groups. So how did you go about finding sources, and how do you feel like you were able to, or do you feel like you were able to adequately get a representative sample of letters?
The answer to the second question is maybe a little bit. Yeah. So maybe, you know, yeah. It's as representative as I could make it.
Sure.
And I am extraordinarily grateful, for example, to the Canadian Letters and Images Project out of Nanaimo, where they have requested families to send whatever, you know, digitized copies of whatever family memento they have. And so I was able to dig up a lot of information, a lot of collections of letters from there. There are, of course, some very extensive collections in the Library and Archives Canada and in the War Museum. So I first went to Ottawa. And I did so, obviously, because National Archives are probably a place that will hold these kinds of documents, but also because, another family connection, my mother was elderly and she lived in Ottawa, and I could go and work in the archives during the day and visit with my mom in the evenings.
Yeah. And so a win-win, really.
Yeah. It was, yeah. And she was interested because of her own family background. It was her grandfather who died in the war. She was interested to hear me tell what I discovered in the archives. Right. So going to Ottawa made good sense professionally, but it made good sense personally as well. And then I thought, well, what else, other sources are there out there? And you've probably gleaned from the book that I was able to extract quite interesting information about the pathways Canadian wives took from the service records of their husbands. And now that all of those service records have been digitized, I was able to create a database of Manitoba soldiers. And we can talk about why I chose Manitoba in a minute if we want to. But it was manageable. There were too many people in Ontario to do it. And Manitoba had a very high enlistment rate. And Manitoba also had census data from the middle of the war. So I was able to use that. Right. And Manitoba was where I grew up. So when they were talking about different parts of Winnipeg, I knew what they were talking about.
Right, yeah. Which is important when you're reading letters and people are making references. You got to kind of know what they're talking about.
Yeah, and you know, I would know that if they moved from this street to that street, they were either moving two blocks or halfway across the city.
Yeah.
So focusing on Manitoba made good sense, both because it was a manageable subset of the collection, and because it was a subset that was rich because of the 1916 census, that was, I was able to use that to find out, oh, this couple had lived on this street when he enlisted, and by 1916, she's now living with her parents. So right. That's a way of thinking about how war wives coped. And because it was a place that I knew. And so, you know, so I was frustrated that, for example, I couldn't find any collections that gave me an understanding of the Quebecois experience. There, you know, it seems there were obviously Quebecois soldiers, but it seems that more of them were unmarried, so that the French Canadian troop men married earlier and then felt, understandably, that they had sort of a moral responsibility to stay at home. They didn't have the same direct ties to the old country, to England, as many of the soldiers in Toronto or Winnipeg or Vancouver did. So that was a point of frustration. There's very little that comes out from the Maritimes. And there, too, I think it's that the opportunities for men to do their bit for the war, whether as coal miners, for example, was something that was emphasized. This is your patriotic duty as well. This is a way for you to help win the war.
Right.
And so the impetus to join up was not as pressing, I think, in the Maritimes. Mm-hmm. So I would, you know, there is an occasional soldier, like poor guy who comes home to discover his wife has run off with the Baptist minister. So it's not that there were no men from the Maritimes who were part of the war effort, but I didn't find the same richness of sources. Right. So geographically, I think the collection is not as representative as I would have wanted it to be.
Yeah. And that's, as you say, there's a lot of reasons for that and understandable reasons as well. So as we get into the book, I'm really curious about, I kind of want to sort of take it in the way it's laid out in the book, which is chronologically. And I'm curious about the push factors. And there's so much that is discussed on why people enlist and why people go to war. And, you know, the narrative now, if you go to a Remembrance Day ceremony and you talk, and a lot of it as well, they for king and country, and they went and fought for freedom and all that. And when you read letters and look at personnel files, you see, well, a lot of people went for other reasons, whether it was the adventure of it. Some people did go for king and country. Some people went for, it was a trip back to Europe if they had immigrated from England. Other people, to be quite frank, were going because it was a job and three meals a day. And economically, it was a good choice for them to go. But that's all usually framed from the soldier's perspective as to why the soldier is enlisting and going. When you're looking at the push factors and those initial recruitment moments, what's happening for women and the wives of these men, and what is their perspective, and what are the push factors for them in whether encouraging their husbands to go, or in other cases, potentially encouraging them not to go?
Right. I think initially there was much more pushback against married men, husbands enlisting. There was certainly the sense, yes, you'll have a regular job, so that's good. But that was really almost a last resort. If the husband had been unemployed, if the family was facing eviction, then joining up made good sense. But I think for many families in more stable circumstances, the idea of sending your husband off to war was something that women quite understandably resisted. Sure. And in some cases, soldiers circumvented their wives' resistance by pretending that their wife had given permission for them to enlist when they hadn't, by pretending that they were single when they were in fact married, or by slowly working away at their wives' resistance over several months.
Right.
So maybe I can't enlist in August and September, but maybe by November or January of 1915, I can begin to make the case that this is something that I need to do as a man, and I need to do it to protect my family. And that's where the new spirit of enlistment propaganda really came into play, that you need to enlist because if you don't and the Germans win, all kinds of terrible things will happen to your family.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of the posters that are relevant to Canada or Canada specific do have Canada represented by a woman dressed in white who's under threat by a German. And there's a great poster. It's British, but I actually have a copy of it that I have in my office. It's Women of Britain Say Go, that famous poster of the men marching off. And so it's propaganda directed at the women, telling them, hey, send your husbands off, like it's okay. Within this dynamic, is there a difference for fathers as opposed to husbands without children? Is there a distinction being made in the same way?
I think so. I think that there's a reason that the largest uptick in married men's enlistment, and particularly married men who were in their late 20s, early 30s, so people who have married and have a few children at home, are waiting until 1916. because that's when the propaganda machine really ramped up.
Right.
And women were being accosted on streetcars in Toronto with, like, it's your duty to send your husband or your brother or your son to war. So they were getting this very directly. And husbands were thinking about, you know, what do I need to do as a family man? Should I stay at home? And many people decide that that's the right thing to do. But if I have family back in Britain, do I have some kind of obligation to help defend against the threat of the British Isles being invaded? Right. So I think the fact that so many of the men, the married men who enlisted, had very close family connections, parents, siblings, still in England or Ireland or Scotland, lots in Scotland, felt that they should enlist was because they had a sense of a broader family that needed and had to be defended.
So, yeah, and that's a really good point that, yeah, family, especially at this time, extends beyond Canada and extends beyond the home. Sort of, I think in the 21st century, we tend to think of immediate family as, you know, mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, grandkids, and that. Like, yeah. But we don't think of extended family in the same way as 100 years ago when people are talking about family, and they really do mean the big extended family, even when there's not a blood relation. I realize there are certainly families that don't have blood relations today too, but I just feel like it's a changing conception of what a family is. So once the men are over and the correspondence starts, you start to see, and the title of the chapter is Marriage by Correspondence. And how does one, or how did individuals maintain a marriage through correspondence? And do you see an evolution in the collections you're looking at in how husbands and wives are writing to each other as the conflict deepens, as the separation extends, and as the reality of what's happening really starts to set in for both sides?
I think so. I think that there is a reticence at first on the part of both wives and husbands to be fully forthcoming about their experiences. Hmm. So not only what it's like to be in pitched battle, but also what it's like to deal with a little child who's come down with whooping cough.
Right.
Do you share that information with a husband who's likely to get that letter 3 or 4 weeks later? Maybe by that time the crisis is over. What's the point of worrying about it? Yeah. So I do think initially there is a degree of reticence. There's also a sense that the official censorship regime is going to be very strict in telling soldiers what they can and cannot say. So in nearly all of these cases, initially, the soldiers are saying, I wish I could tell you more, but I can't because the censors are going to prevent it. I wish I could tell you more about the war, but I wish I could tell you more about how much I love you and how much I miss you and how much I wish that I were at home so that you could, you know, rub my back or whatever. And so there is a degree of reticence there that wasn't evident when I was reading the letters that French soldiers were writing.
Yeah, because I've just heard of stories of, as censorship continues and goes on, that in some cases there are sergeants who are charged with reading the letters of the lance corporals and privates who are below them. And the sergeant's coming back and saying, in some cases, hey, this guy's older than me. He has a wife. He's writing to her in these sometimes very like explicit way. Yeah. I don't feel comfortable reading this. Like, what are we doing here? But that was just sort of the nature of it. And then these two guys have to interact with each other. It feels like the censorship regime would greatly influence the letters, because it's not always just this unknown person who could black something out in your letter. It's somebody who you're going into the trenches with, who you're rotating in and out with, who's reading what you're writing.
Yes, and that was so obvious in the way in which rank and file soldiers responded, that they would be embarrassed to have someone sitting 3 feet from them reading their most intimate correspondence. Whereas in the French case, their letters were being censored 15 miles behind the line. Right. So whoever was reading them didn't know who they were. Right. And they developed just like, I don't give a whatever. if they, you know, read this, they don't know who I am. Yeah. So what the heck? But what I did find was interesting was eventually, both for the soldiers and for their wives, there comes a point when needing to share their experiences and their anxieties becomes more important than just putting on a good face. Hmm. And they would do this sometimes, you know, they would be given these green envelopes that would allow them to write more openly, or at least without the intrusion of your, you know, junior officer reading your letter. Hmm. So they could use these green envelopes to send letters home. They would be subject to censorship further down the line, but once again, not by someone who knew them, not by someone they were in the same unit or company with. So the green envelopes were kind of a lifesaver in that way. Mm-hmm. Being home, they couldn't go home on leave, they couldn't go back to Canada, but if they went to the UK on leave, as most Canadian soldiers did, they could use the civilian mails to send letters home. Mm-hmm. And so they were able to, you know, get around the very real constraints of the censorship regime often enough that they were able to use their letter writing as sort of a psychological event. They were able to unburden themselves with their anxieties and their experiences, and sometimes their confessions of things that they had done in the trenches that they then came to wonder about whether they should have done. So the letter, there isn't a frequency that I saw in the French correspondence of sharing this information, but it does emerge as they become more and more inured to the thought, well, we don't even know when this war is going to end.
Yeah.
And so we do need to give witness to it. And I think the longer soldiers survived, the more aware they were that they might not survive much longer. And so putting down in writing some testimony, I think, became more and more important.
Well, I wonder about the idea of just it being normalized, right? And totally different context, and I don't want to sound like I'm equating it at all, but I've talked to a lot of curlers who, the first time they play on TV, it's weird. They're wearing the microphone, the cameras are right there, and you're not used to that when you're curling. But after you've done a couple events where there's cameras, they say they don't even notice it anymore. They don't feel the mic. And so when they curse and do stuff that they're not necessarily proud of, they're like, oh yeah, I forgot I was on TV.
Yeah.
Is that kind of the same thing potentially with the letters, that the experience over time, at the start, yeah, you might be a little self-conscious, you're aware of the censorship, but after a year, 2 years, 3 years, you know, if you're there from the start, it just becomes normal. This is your life. This is how you're communicating with your wife. This is how you're communicating with your husband back. Like, this is just what your relationship becomes. So I'm just going to write as I would speak to you. And that's what it is. There an element of that, of just getting comfortable in this situation?
I think there is. And I think, though I can't prove it, that the men who were responsible for censoring the letters, as you suggested, became willing to turn a blind eye to what was being written. So, right. For example, there are these letters that Frank Mahut sent to his wife after the Somme. And as best we can determine, they were not sent, he was not on leave in England. They were not sent home in a green envelope because there weren't any green envelopes at that point in the battle. So he was able to describe some pretty grisly experiences and get the letter sent home without any interference. Mm. And maybe he just knew, as you said, you know, he was a sergeant and he was older than the lieutenant who was probably, you know, respond. Maybe his lieutenant just said, yeah, just write it, you know, I'll sign the envelope and we'll go from there. And maybe they thought this is what needs to happen in order for these men to decompress, right, to be able to, to share, to get things off their chest. Now, I talk of it in the book as like a writing cure. So in the same way that if you're in a psychologist's office, you might have a talking cure. For them, it was a writing cure. And maybe their immediate commanding officers, the men who were responsible for censoring their letters, thought the benefits of that far outweighed whatever strategic damage might be done by someone receiving a letter 3 weeks after a battle was already over.
Right. Yeah. And I think that time is really important, that, as you say, in the French case, it could be a day or two from a letter being written to received. In the Canadian context, certainly not the case. It takes a long time. The ocean is very big. So it takes a long time for letters to get back and forth. And the book gets into the idea of coping and coping with this situation. And one thing I'm curious about is the uncertainty that goes along with the war. So a woman at home can write a letter to her husband and not be sure that he's going to get it, that by the time it gets to him, something could have happened, that he's in a battle, he's killed, and that's that. Husbands, the same way, can write letters home and say, well, I might be gone before that gets here or gets home. And on the women's side, at the home front side, that seems worse, right? The same way that athletes always talk about, it's way worse to watch somebody than actually play the game. I get the sense that that's probably a similar idea, that it's the uncertainty, the not knowing, that would really just weigh on women. And in the letters that you're seeing, in the correspondence and the other materials that you're looking at, how are women dealing with that uncertainty? And how is it expressed in some of the letters? Are there trends that emerge in how they're trying to deal with just the unknowing that is necessary in this situation?
I think first they become accustomed to the idea that they are not going to receive word regularly. So it will be, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, depending on the weather and the winter and all that stuff, before they receive confirmation that at least 3 weeks ago, he was still alive.
Right.
So there's a different sense of time. If you're in Britain or in France and you go for 3 or 4 days without a letter, then you start to get anxious. If you're in Canada and you go for 3 weeks without a letter, maybe you start to feel a little antsy about it.
But also maybe the mail's backed up, or like the tides, exactly, or like the current in the ocean is bad this time. Like, right, you just don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you go for 4 weeks or 5 weeks and you still haven't heard anything, then you begin to wonder what's happening. And there's a case that I cite in the book of this woman in Winnipeg, Betty Maisie, who was persuaded that her husband was at Vimy. And she hadn't received information from him to say that, in fact, he had been quarantined because his company had the measles. And so they were all sitting in England with spots all over their faces, but they weren't at Vimy. But she didn't know that. And she went for weeks, after the newspapers are proclaiming the wonders of the battle and so forth, she went for weeks not hearing from him. And it got to the point where she almost had a mental breakdown. And she describes how she tried to allay her anxiety by working, by just being fanatic about cleaning the house. She, she did everything you could possibly imagine and then some, just to keep busy.
Sure.
So that she wasn't sitting in the living room wondering, is the mailman going to show up today? Or worse, is a telegram going to show up today?
Right. Yeah, the First World War equivalent of doom scrolling, essentially, that we have now. That you're just trying to keep your mind occupied so that it doesn't go into the various various ways or areas that it can. Within that, one of the things that the book talks about too is this sort of movement of women and the ability for them, in some cases, go back across the ocean. And what is this process like, and how are women responding and this desire to see their husbands, and certainly towards the end of the war, see where they fought. We talk about pilgrimages after the war as well. But what is this? Is there a movement? Is there an is there sort of this organized collection of women? How are they working towards this goal of, in some cases, going back over or just trying to bridge that gap?
I think that for most Canadian war wives, the most common response to marital separation was trying to find, to tap into the emotional and economic, material resources that an extended family could provide. That being alone with your worries every night was not going to be good for your health. Sure. And I think they understood that in an intuitive way. So in many, many cases, they relocated. Some of them just moved a few blocks. So they lived with their in-laws or their parents. Sometimes they lived with other siblings. But they created sort of an extended family that could provide companionship, that could provide childcare, that could provide some kind of emotional response and support. And in some cases, that entailed going great distances. The evidence of families that had recently, you know, 1912, 1913, moved out west and then decided that they were in some small town in northern Alberta by themselves. They needed to reconnect to family in the Maritimes or in Montreal or in Quebec or in Toronto. So they would move across the country. But many of the married men who enlisted were recent immigrants from Britain. And the wives were, not all of the wives were, but many of the wives were as well. So their extended family was in England or in Scotland or in Ireland. And for them, the disruption of packing your kids up, taking them across the country by train, getting onto something like a troop ship to, you know, go across the ocean, especially in 1915 when the ocean was being tormented by submarines, was a pretty daunting undertaking. But the advantages of family outweighed the costs of relocation. And as you've already suggested, the one great advantage of going back to the old country was that when your husband came home on leave, you could see him. Whereas for Canadian wives, it was that uninterrupted absence that just wore away at their nerves and just eroded their sense of well-being. May Rogers said, if only Laurie could come home for a while, so loneliness is eating her heart out.
That really hits, right? There's no ambiguity in what she's saying there. Yes. Something else I'm wondering, though, and again with the separation of it, I have heard, I don't know if this is accurate, I've never actually done the follow-up on this, but if a soldier got VD and was hospitalized, and I believe you stopped getting pay if you got VD, that information was not conveyed to the family back home or to, if he was married, to the wife. But whether or not that's true or not, it does speak to the reality of when you're gone for years, things can happen, both on, for both the woman at home and the man overseas. And certainly sexuality comes up a lot when we're talking about men on the front lines when they're on leave and going behind. But similarly with the case of the women at home, that there's the great uncertainty of both, is he alive, is he dead? But also, you know, there are stories of war brides and meeting and VDs going around. Like, what about women who are meeting other people and finding other companions, other men? Like, what's the situation there at home? And how are, or did you come across any situations where that was the case? And is it being addressed in letters at all?
I did come across cases of women who abandoned their marital vows and commitment, sometimes almost as soon as their husbands had left war, sometimes shortly thereafter. And that evidence comes to light after the soldier comes home and discovers that his wife has abandoned ship.
Right.
And so he would write, there are letters that I discovered in the Ministry of Justice archives in Ottawa of soldiers asking how they can get a divorce, given that their wife had clearly committed adultery and in some cases had just disappeared.
Right.
So there is evidence of that. And the sort of narrative that develops after the war is that female infidelity was really the driving force of marital breakdown, that soldiers had been wronged by wives who were unfaithful and indifferent to their marriage vows. Yes, there are cases of that, and these soldiers gave evidence to that effect. I came across no written evidence, no written support that had a woman writing to her husband and saying, I hope you're being faithful.
Right.
Though I'm sure she wondered.
Yeah, it's like that old joke where soldier's on deployment somewhere in the tropics, and he writes and he says, there's all these women around, I'm so distracted. And she says, well, here, I'm sending you a flute or bagpipes or whatever. Practice that. And then he comes home and he says, all right, like I'm home. And she says, now, before we do anything, let's see how well you play those bagpipes. Like, let's sort of take it easy here first. But yeah, like it does seem like a very reasonable question to be asked. Is it really on both sides that there is that separation? Now, after the war, and this is another section of the book that I was very interested in, men come home, the ones who survive and live through the war. And especially for the ones who are gone years, like multiple years, you are changed. Your wife is different as well from the experience of being home. Like, everything has changed in your life. How do you track these people whence they come home and trying to understand the situation when soldiers are coming home to a completely different dynamic? He's different, she's different, they're trying to make it work. Just how did you go about trying to track that? And what are some of the things that really emerged in that post-war period for you?
The great frustration is, of course, that when the war is over, there's no need to write letters.
Right, yeah.
And so there is very little direct epistolary evidence of readjusting. And so it's really a function of looking for indirect evidence. And that indirect evidence almost inevitably will cite the worst cases of challenges to readjustment. It will be people who are so economically down on their luck that they need the support of local authorities, they need the support of local charities, they need interventions from sometimes church organizations who can go out and witness the difficulties that these soldiers are having in terms of readjustment. Sure. And whether it's that they don't have a job because they have been wounded to the point that they cannot hold down the job that they had before the war, but are not so wounded that they qualify for a full disability pension. So in that case, they feel frustrated that they can't resume the life that they thought they would have.
Yep.
Or whether they are given to drink. I mean, I think there's a lot of evidence that one of the coping mechanisms for men in the front lines was you drank alcohol.
Sure.
And the government sort of went along with that and gave people, you know, their tot of rum in the morning and so forth. And so a dependence on alcohol would in some cases become so debilitating as to make it difficult for a couple to readjust. And then the saddest cases, they're all sad to be honest, are the soldiers who are struggling with some form of PTSD and who are trying as best they can to reconstruct their pre-war lives, but whose mental states and psychological states are so fragile that it becomes impossible for them to do so. So unfortunately, the archival record, which is fascinating, tends to focus on the worst case scenarios. And we don't have a lot of evidence about the people who came home. Maybe they had a few squabbles about, you know, this is why I've been doing it for the last 3 years and you're telling me I'm not doing it right. What are you talking about? But who nonetheless figured things out and stayed married for the next 40 years or whatever. There are glimmers of that. There's one case of a soldier who came back from the war, went on the Allied intervention force to Russia, became fascinated with the history of Russia, and became a prominent historian of Russian history for the rest of his career, and seems to have succeeded very well, and his wife seems to have done so as well. So yeah, there are couples who made it work. And then there were the ones that are who show up in the archives who for whatever reasons couldn't make it work.
Does the post-war experience of couples influence the way you look at some of their letters? Like if the war experience and the letters are you know, I can't wait to see you, I love you, here's the update, all that, and then they come home and it doesn't work anymore. Does that alter the way you think about the letters? Or similarly, if they're loving letters back and forth and come home and they live a happy life together, like does the post-war really influence the way you think of those letters and the meaning of the letters in the moment?
I think the best example of that comes out of the letters of Frank Mahur and his wife Angeline. They lived in this small logging community north of Ottawa. The letters are extraordinary, and they are very emotional. And of all the letters that I read from Canadian soldiers, they are the closest that come to being outright erotic. And so there emerges this very strong sense of a marriage that is very passionate, that is very respectful. And, you know, when Angeline wants to know, should I do this or should I do that? His response is, you know best. So he's willing to offer her the opportunity, the autonomy to make the decisions because she's not there. And he trusts that she'll make the right decisions. So from the letters, you get this feeling that this is a very robust and successful marriage. The fact that he had to lie a little bit in order to enlist suggests that there were certain things that he wasn't quite willing to talk about with her. But the letters create that sense. It's a strong marriage. It's very open. It's very affectionate. And then I read the article that said that he was hospitalized with VD. Okay. That's not something he wrote about in his letters.
Yeah, that didn't come up. He didn't mention that. Yeah, strange. Yeah,
somehow slipped his mind. Obviously, the strong presumption was that you weren't sent home until you were cured. So that whether she ever knew that that had been part of his war experience, whether she knew and sort of said, well, that's what happens in war, we don't know. Right. All we know is that they stayed married for a long time.
Right. So one of these things where, sometimes the letters can give you more questions, right? There's answers in them, but you can get questions as well. So I'm curious, just as sort of a summary of the book, which I realize this is a really unfair thing to say, like, summarize the whole book. But for people who are coming to it, who might be familiar with the First World War, might be familiar with the home front, or the Western Front, whatever it is, but how do you feel like these letters really, and having this better understanding of the letters and the experience of women at home and the way that they're corresponding with husbands on the front. In what way does that enhance our understanding of the First World War for you and Canada's First World War? I mentioned earlier, so much of the narrative is about Vimy and Beaumont in the Newfoundland case, and Canada fought, Canada won, this is where Birth of a Nation, all that kind of stuff. But of course, there's a lot of deeper things going on in the war. So for you, as somebody who has studied this so deeply in so many different national contexts, what does this study and understanding the letters tell us about the war experience for these women who you've studied so deeply?
I think, first of all, it places them back on the stage. That we have known for a long time a great deal about the soldiers' experience. We don't know what it was like to be in the front lines, but we know how soldiers have described it, whether at the time or subsequently in memoirs and so forth. And so there has been a real privileging of the soldiers' experience. And that's legitimate. They were the ones who were fighting a really horrible war. But the unfortunate side effect of that was that, with the exception of the brave young girls who were driving the trams in the streets of London, we don't really know a lot about how the experiences of the war were felt and internalized by women at home, especially ones who didn't go into the public domain.
Right.
So I think putting those women back on the stage and saying the war created for them, in many cases, sort of a set of psychological crises that we have never really appreciated, is an important way to think about. Secondly, I think it's important that we situate the Canadian experience in this broader global sense. And one of the things that I did, or hoped to do, because I was coming at this project from the vantage point of someone who had studied the European experience of war, was to ask, in what ways were the Canadian experiences similar to those in Europe? And in what ways were they importantly different? And one of the conclusions is that Canadian civilians, Canadian wives in particular, didn't suffer the dire economic catastrophe that was prevalent in Central and Eastern Europe to the point that it generated revolution.
Right.
So they weren't starving. And they weren't in direct line of fire, as was the case in northern France and in Belgium. They weren't subjected to ethnic cleansing, as was the case in the Ottomans. So they were protected from some of those truly cataclysmic effects of the war. But precisely because they were so physically separated from the war, I think that they suffered the psychological stresses of absence and separation even more intensely than was the case for women in Europe. So situating the Canadian experience in this comparative context, how are their experiences like those of French or German or British women, and how were they importantly different, is one of the things that I really wanted to emphasize.
And the book does it very, very well. So again, the title is Anxious Days and Tearful Nights, Canadian Wives During the Great War. Martha, if people want to pick up a copy of the book or some of the other work that you've done, what's the best way for them to keep up with everything you've got going on?
Goodness knows.
Okay.
I guess, you go to Amazon and put my name in the bar.
There you go. Yeah. And the book is published in Canada by our friends at McGill Queens. So we will put a link down in the show notes to that. So I encourage you to check it out. Martha, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. And I've taken way more time than I said I would. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
So there you have it. My chat with Martha Hanner, I thank her for her time. And again, Anxious Days and Tearful Nights, Canadian War Wives During the Great War. And with that, let's get right into today's historical headline of the week, which is from the CBC. On August 17, 2024, captured First World War pilot's note reunited with family in Ottawa. This is a very cool story from Arthur White Crummy, profiling a letter that was dropped from a German plane in 1917 over the British front lines, giving an update on two British sailors, Captain Arthur Spencer Allen and Lieutenant Duncan McTavish. Unfortunately, Captain Allen was dead, but Lieutenant McTavish was alive, and this was providing an update on those two. Eventually makes its way back to a family in Great Britain, and Duncan McTavish's daughter, Barbara Welch, is still alive, and the letter was shown to her. She lives here in Ottawa, and the article goes through the process of how the family in Great Britain passed this letter down, finding Barbara Welch and the process of showing her the letter. A very cool story. There's a podcast entitled The Old Front Line that I really enjoy. And on that show, it gets brought up that the final page in the history of the First World War will never be written. And it's stories like this that continue to come up, that over 100 years later, these letters, these connections, even living memory, even though all the soldiers are gone, we have children of the soldiers who are still alive and grandchildren, and those stories get told and retold, and these types of things can still happen. So it's a very, very cool reminder that the First World War and those experiences still resonate today in a very powerful way. So I'd encourage you to read it. It's just an amazing profile of how these two families came together. So I was so thrilled to read that story. Very happy to share it as today's historical headline of the week. Captured First World War pilot's note reunited with family in Ottawa from August 17, 2024. And with that, I will say thank you very much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, likes, rates, comments, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. We are back in full swing over there on the website with some great written material. And if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, whatsoldisnews@gmail.com. We got a full slate of new episodes coming. A bunch of them are already recorded. Really thrilled with how they turned out. Think you're going to enjoy them. So please do stick around, subscribe, spread the word, because we got some great stuff coming out this fall. And we're going to keep it rolling next Wednesday when we'll be back with you for more What's Old Is News.